Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the agreement reached today in Moscow between Israel's Prime Minister Netanyahu and Vladimir Putin, aimed at avoiding military clashes between Israel and Russia as Putin increases the deployment of weaponry and boots on the ground in Syria to support the besieged Assad regime. William Pomerantz, the deputy director of the Kennan Institute for Advanced Russian Studies at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, D.C., joins us to discuss Israel's concerns about the transfers of the latest Russian weapons to Hezbollah and whether Putin will send Russian troops into battle against ISIS in Syria ahead of his address to the UN on September the 28th. Then we go to London to discuss explosive allegations in a new biography about the UK's Prime Minister, David Cameron, written by the Conservative Party power broker, Lord Ashcroft, who accuses the Prime Minister of engaging in a sex act with a dead pig when Cameron was a student at Oxford University. Nico Hines, the London editor of the Daily Beast, joins us to discuss his article at the Daily Beast, David Cameron Accused of Sex Act with a Dead Pig, and whether this damning biography being serialized in the Daily Mail that revealed David Cameron's alleged porcine proclivities will hurt his party that rules Parliament with a slim majority. Then finally, we'll go to Iowa for an update on the primary campaigns from a rally for Jeb Bush and speak with David Redlawsk, a polling expert and a professor of political science at Rutgers University and a fellow at the Harkin Institute at Drake University in Des Moines, Iowa. We'll discuss the latest polls released since the second Republican presidential debate last Wednesday that show Governor Scott Walker at less than 1%, forcing him to drop out of the race, but have Trump still in the lead, although there are indications that Carly Fiorina is making an advancement from her earlier negligible polling. And joining us now is William Pomerantz, who's the Deputy Director of the Kennan Institute for Advanced Russian Studies at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, D.C. He also teaches Russian law at the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at Georgetown University. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Pomerantz.
Glad to be here.
And the deal that Prime Minister Netanyahu and Vladimir Putin struck in Moscow, first of all, Prime Minister Netanyahu took a delegation, including his national security advisor, the chief of his military, and chief of his military intelligence. Given how many times Israel has struck Hezbollah, what do you think is the deal here? Because Russia has put in, I believe, four of these Sukhoi fighters, but now they've got another 24, I think, that are showing up today. So they are building up. And Novaya Gazeta, the only independent newspaper left in Russia, says they quote military sources who say that Russia's going to engage ISIS before or during or after President Putin's address to the UN on September the 28th.
Well, I think that from Israel's perspective, the fear is that they might engage with Russia while they're going after various forces of Hezbollah and other groups on the ground. So I think it was a very practical discussion between Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Putin just to avoid those types of potential casualties that could escalate the crisis that much further. Whether Russia is about to engage ISIS before President Putin's speech next week, that would require a major military effort by the Russians in Syria at a time when it's unclear whether they have sufficient forces. I mean, they only have estimated about 2,000 troops on the ground. Whether they're about to send those troops and engage with ISIS directly, we'll just have to wait and see. But I think it's unlikely, only because I'm not sure Russia is ready to accept the casualties that would come from such an attack.
Well, the rebels, and in this case, it's in the area of Damascus and Dumia that the rebels can control, and they're moving slowly and slowly into Damascus. And that is apparently one of the reasons for this mass exodus into Europe. A lot of these refugees are coming from Damascus. Apparently on Sunday, I think it was either the Islamic Army or al-Nusra that lobbed mortar bombs into the Russian compound at their embassy in Damascus.
Yes, again, I mean, it's not as if there is the possibility that Russia somehow gets dragged into the fight. But again, I still remain it still remains unclear whether Russia is actively trying to engage in this war. One has to remember that Russia is already engaged in a major war in Ukraine, and whether Russia really wants to fight two wars on two different continents, that is a tremendous logistical challenge. And I'm not sure Russia is really capable of mounting such a challenge.
So then what is this military buildup about?
I think it's partially to distract people inside Russia. Again, it reflects in many ways political developments. The Russian people, according to public opinion polls, are getting tired of the fight in Ukraine. President Putin relies on essentially raising the national security concerns in order to maintain his popular support. If Ukraine can't do it, then I think Putin is considering that Syria might be able to substitute. He could be able to theoretically play the hero role to show that Russia is a decisive international military power and so forth. So I believe that Putin is doing so in large part because of a domestic political situation that requires him to be perceived as a major international player and leader. That's no longer working in Ukraine, so I think he's moved on to Syria.
And again, I'm speaking with William Pomerantz, who's the deputy director of the Kennan Institute for Advanced Russian Studies at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, D.C. He also teaches Russian law at the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at Georgetown University. So what about the dimension, though, of these two leaders who Obama and Putin used to talk an awful lot on the phone, and apparently these conversations went on for hours. They not necessarily came to any agreement because apparently Putin has his own view of the world, and it's pretty hard to shake that. But since Crimea and Ukraine, they have not spoken, as far as I know. And the New York Times, in an editorial today, mentioned that that Obama thinks Putin is a thug and Putin thinks Obama is a weakling. So what's at play between these two personalities? Do they have something to prove to each other?
Well, I don't know if at this stage they have anything to prove to each other because President Obama has a short amount of time left in his office. And it's quite clear that President Putin has a much longer tenure in office. I don't think that they have right now a lot to talk about. I don't think, as of right now at least, there's going to be a side meeting at the UN when Putin goes to New York next week. And again, President Obama has invested a lot of political capital during his first term in trying to improve U.S.-Russian relations, and it didn't really pay off. So I doubt that at this late stage, President Obama is going to invest a lot of political capital to deal with President Putin. And President Putin, I believe, thinks he can wait out to whoever is going to be the next president. Unfortunately, I don't know if Mr. Putin is watching the Republican debates, but I don't think he's going to get someone who's more willing to negotiate with him, no matter who's elected president in 2016.
Well, Donald Trump is saying, or his people are saying, that there might be a meeting in New York when Putin's at the UN between Trump and Putin.
Well, I'm sure it will be quite a show. Most of the things that Mr. Trump does it will be big, it will be loud,
it'll be fabulous. It'll be amazing.
You
can't wait. He'll be joining the ranks of Steven Seagal and Jean-Paul Van Damme and all of Putin's friends in the West, but on a more serious note, the two defense ministers have spoken about this Russian buildup in Syria, and the fact that the Israelis made a deal today and they sent all of their top military people to Moscow with Netanyahu would indicate that the U.S. must have made some kind of deal for the planes, Russian and American planes, not to get into a dogfight. And likewise, it's always been assumed that Israel is the wild card, that the U.S. may be restrained, and they certainly were during the Cold War. But during the Cold War, the Israelis really hurt the Russians badly in Syria. The Russians lost hundreds of men in various clashes between Syria and Israel, where Israel attacked a lot of Syrian positions being manned and maintained by Russian military. And I was told recently by Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, an independent military analyst in Moscow, that three Russian generals were killed in these battles between Israel and Syria. So I take it that the Russians take the Israelis pretty seriously.
Yes, they do take the Israelis seriously. And again, I want to emphasize that there's a big question as to whether Russia can really take casualties in Syria. Right now, they declared the casualties that they're taking in Ukraine as top secret, and they don't. There is no information about it. But unfortunately, if indeed they engage with ISIS, and if ISIS were to capture Russian soldiers, then they would not be able to hide behind their denials of non-engagement, and they would have to deal with some very unfortunate and no doubt brutal footage dealing with any potential Russian captive. So it is a very difficult position if Putin really wants to engage with ISIS, because he'll have to explain these casualties. And even during the Chechen War, for example, Russians were very much were very upset, and there were various organizations that opposed the war, all because of the level of casualties.
So if then, and you're quite right, of course, there you can't have a totally antiseptic war, and this is house-to-house fighting, so it's very difficult to see how the military edge with this new equipment, with ground-to-air missiles, fighter jets, and also tanks and armed personnel carriers, how in an urban situation, which is where the real battle line is, particularly in Damascus, it's going to make much of a difference. So that probably would indicate that at some point or other there would be Russian casualties. But on the other hand, one has to assume that Putin and the Iranians are very concerned that Assad is going to fold. And my understanding is that if it weren't for the Iranians and Hezbollah and Russia, Assad would have already folded.
Well, again, I mean, Russia may be trying to keep Assad politically alive, but clearly the United States is not interested in negotiating with Assad yet. And that's really not the path towards political negotiations as of yet. So they may be concerned about keeping Assad politically viable. But again, they're not about to reconstitute a country of Syria with Assad as president. That's just not about to happen. So I'm not quite sure what Russia's long-term strategy really is here. They're not about to reunite the country, and they're not in a position to stop the flow of refugees, as far as I can tell. So it's very unclear how Russia, with its relatively small buildup, but substantial buildup, begins to change the forces on the ground in Syria.
Well, but Assad has lost 85% of his territory, so the trend line is pretty clear.
Exactly. So they may be trying to show to the world that Russia sticks by its allies to the bitter end. And clearly, Mr. Assad was one of the major purchasers of Russian arms, and they don't want to lose one of their better customers. But nevertheless, they may be willing to fight with Assad here at the end, but it's not as if he's about to reestablish himself as a president of a united country. So you have to ask yourself, why is Russia doing this? Is it to kind of enhance its role, to somehow play the spoiler again? I don't believe at this stage that it really has enough force to really play that role. So it's, again, one remains puzzled why Putin would engage in Syria other than to enhance his reputation and to somehow try to show Russia as a major international player. But even if that's the case, I don't think they can necessarily save Assad, and they definitely can't put Syria back together.
Well, just in closing, you mentioned the refugee crisis in Europe, and it would seem to me that Putin is perfectly happy to see that refugee crisis divide Europe, particularly divide Eastern Europe and Western Europe, Putin has given money to the right-wing fascist governments in opposition in France, for example. He's an ally of Orbán, the prime minister, the right-wing prime minister in Hungary, who's mistreating the immigrants at the moment. So I would have thought, my assumption is that Putin would be perfectly happy to have more refugees flow into Europe.
He may just be, and obviously he's created a lot of refugees in Ukraine as well. Putin's strategy with Europe is really divide and conquer. And if he's able to do that, for example, if he can convince some countries to vote against the next extension of sanctions in January 2016, then he has a chance of really changing the facts on the ground in Ukraine. So far, he hasn't been able to do so. But indeed, one of Putin's primary motivations, indeed one of the few ways that he kind of comes out on top of this crisis, is if he divides Europe to the point that it cannot respond to the situation in Ukraine, or in that case, the situation relative to the refugees. So it's one of his strategies, and it is a test of Europe. If Europe is not able to remain unified, then Putin would have actually achieved a major success.
Well, William Pomerantz, I thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with William Pomerantz, who's the Deputy Director of the Kennan Institute for Advanced Russian Studies at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, D.C. He also teaches Russian law at the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at Georgetown University. We're going to take a brief station break and be back, and then go to London to discuss explosive allegations in a new biography about UK's Prime Minister David Cameron.
From Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you. I've traveled the world.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from London is Nico Hines, who's the London editor of The Daily Beast, who previously was a reporter for The Times of London and more recently their Washington correspondent. His latest article at The Daily Beast is David Cameron Accused of Sex Act with a Dead Pig. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nico Hines.
Hello.
And I guess at least it wasn't a live pig.
Arguably that would be better. Although I'm not sure, because there are laws against sexual acts with dead people, with animals. I'm not sure exactly what the law is on sex with dead animals.
But David Cameron, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, has yet to respond to these allegations in a new book by Lord Ashcroft, who is a pretty prominent figure. The biography of David Cameron is called Call Me Dave. And I guess here in the U.S., we all remember Bill Clinton, President Bill Clinton, wagging his finger at the camera and saying, I never had sex with that woman. Is David Cameron going to wag his finger at the camera and say, I never had sex with that pig?
It seems at this point that Downing Street and David Cameron's advisers have suggested a policy of just ignoring this and hoping it blows over, hoping that by maybe allowing a few background briefings about the motivation of this book, that there might be enough doubt caused and that David Cameron won't ever be in that awful position of having to actually deny that he had done these unspeakable things.
And these unspeakable things allegedly happened at a debauched Oxford University club that he belonged to.
Yes, and this is where some of the details are a bit unclear. We do know for a fact that David Cameron was a member of something called the Bullingdon Club, which was frequented by only the very, very richest, very, very poshest students at Oxford University, which obviously has plenty of posh students there already. So it's an extremely elite group. And that was quite an unpleasant group which would kind of go out, get very drunk, behave badly, smash things up, and generally show their disdain for the poor. This second group that he's alleged to have been involved with is a far more secretive group where there are no photos that we would be able to, there are no group official photos that we would be able to prove whether or not he was a member. And in fact, some members say there weren't kind of, there wasn't a real membership. It was just that people would hang out at certain secretive events and get up to mischief. So there's no hard proof that David Cameron was a member of this. The story in the book alleges that during a kind of initiation ceremony, or perhaps just one of these debauched parties, that he actually placed a certain part of his anatomy into the mouth of a dead pig's head.
And this secret society, I guess, here in the U.S., we'd probably, there are certain analogies, I suppose, with George W. Bush's membership of the Skull and Bones at Yale, although there's no evidence that the Yaleys get up to anything quite as bizarre as is alleged here.
That's right. You know, I think a lot of universities have these kinds of things. And you find that at the most elite universities, there are ways for those people who consider themselves even to be above the rest of the elite can carve themselves out a little corner and find shared secrets, so we've put it that way, which they can then kind of convince themselves that they have their own little special part of the world.
So these accusations, though, Nico Hines, wouldn't be so off the wall and bizarre, and it's odd to even have it in a conversation on the radio to be talking about these things, but it is, after all, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom who is being accused, and the person who's accusing him is not exactly, you know, some yellow press nobody. This is one of the most powerful conservatives in the UK. I mean, some of his credentials are pretty extraordinary. I mean, he has been, in terms of his influence, he's been compared to the Koch brothers. But this is not just, you know, some sort of journalist with a grudge, is it? I mean, it may be, the man may well have a grudge, but he's certainly a powerful figure.
I mean, in many ways, he's much more powerful than the Koch brothers. Not in terms of the sums of money that he's donated, because, of course, in Britain, we don't have the kind of largesse that US political donors dole out. But Lord Ashcroft, by his own reckoning, donated about $12 million to the Conservative Party, which made him far and away the biggest donor to the party. But more importantly, well, I suppose as a result of those donations, he also set up a kind of political operation which is still running to this day, which does a lot of polling. And he has a kind of team of political analysts and experts. And in fact, during the 2010 and 2015 elections, his people have worked very closely with the Conservative Party itself in order to analyse data, in order to decide which seats ought to be targeted. And in 2010, he was actually invited to have an office in the Conservative Party headquarters. So while the Kochs are a sort of people who are trying to influence the Republican Party, this was actually a man who was at the very centre of the Conservative Party and was even given the title of deputy chairman.
And of course, he was also the former treasurer. So, but what's the basis of his falling out with Cameron? How personal is this? And by the way, we forgot to mention that this is being serialized, this book, in the Daily Mail, which is a large daily newspaper. So, and it'll be serialized through the rest of this week, I take it. So this story is not going to go away, is it?
Well, Cameron will be hoping that today was the big punch and that these were the biggest allegations. But no, you're quite right. That we don't know how many days the serialisation is due to go on for, but it could well be that they've saved some... Well, there won't be any more extraordinary allegation, I'm pretty sure of that. But there could potentially be some more serious allegations. One of the serious allegations, which hasn't had as much play in the US, obviously, is that Lord Ashcroft is alleging that David Cameron knew a lot more about his tax arrangements, which were a big story over here because Lord Ashcroft was non-domiciled within the United Kingdom, which meant he didn't pay the right amount of tax. And David Cameron always claimed he didn't know about that. But Lord Ashcroft's now saying, in fact, he knew all about it all along, which, although it sounds a bit technical and boring, would actually represent rather a serious, a lie, basically, that he told to the electorate. The reason they fell out is detailed in this book, and Ashcroft has not hidden that. He insists that this is not just a case of revenge, but he does admit that he fell out with the British Prime Minister after he was elected in 2010. He says that he was promised that he would get a good job once David Cameron entered government. And then when all of the stories about the tax affairs were published, suddenly David Cameron backed out of that promise and eventually offered him a very junior role, which Lord Ashcroft turned down. And from that moment on, he distrusted him. And he even quotes one of David Cameron's senior advisers saying that David Cameron's word is not as good as the paper it's written on.
And again, I'm speaking with Nico Hines, who's in London, where he's the London editor of the Daily Beast. He was previously a reporter for the Times of London and more recently their Washington correspondent. And his latest article at the Daily Beast is David Cameron accused of sex act with a dead pig. Now, Lord Ashcroft, whose book has just come out and is being serialised in the Daily Mail, it's a new biography of David Cameron titled Call Me Dave. In terms of the contribution, though, that Lord Ashcroft has made to the Conservative Party, isn't that pretty significant? This is a very rich businessman who has a rags-to-riches story himself. As you mentioned, he's domiciled in Belize and obviously doesn't pay taxes, as Mitt Romney over here, we learned, also didn't. But can't you make the case that he kind of modernized the Conservative Party?
That's right. Well, him and David Cameron were a great double act for a long time. It was Lord Ashcroft who was so disappointed during the, you know, popular Tony Blair Labour years, when for the first time ever the Labour Party, the Britain's left-wing major party, was the party of government for over a decade. And Lord Ashcroft set about trying to work out how it would be that you could get the Conservatives back in power. And he spent a great deal of his own money, partly giving it to the Conservatives, but also investing in polling and analysis and kind of studies of the marginal seats and the toss-up races to find out how and why the Conservatives have been out of power and try and think of ways that could get them back into power. And David Cameron was then the embodiment of a kind of young, modernising politician who approached Lord Ashcroft and said, I think we should work together. And Lord Ashcroft quickly realised that this guy could be the face of the modernising approach that he wanted. And so the two of them together were absolutely instrumental in turning the Conservative Party, which was seen as old and out of touch and the nasty party, many things that are often alleged of the Republicans today. He was the kind of fresh face who allowed them to rebrand themselves, and they're now into their second term in power, and most people predict they're going to win the third election as well.
So is there, do you think, more than revenge then? I mean, revenge seems to be the dish that's best served cold. I can understand that there's a case for it. But what else is he trying to do? Do you think this book is going to hurt them? I mean, I guess with Labour being in such disarray and this peculiar outcome of the last election where I believe the Scottish National Party, I think, was it, they got 4% of the vote and yet they won 60 seats or something, and UKIP got 14% of the vote and only got one seat. Is that, am I statistics correct on that?
Yeah, well, it's a slightly complicated thing. The Scottish National Party obviously run only in Scotland, so
right.
While they didn't score a very high percentage across the whole of the United Kingdom, they did fantastically well in Scotland and won virtually all of the seats that they contested. You're right, we do have a very strange political system, and the outcome of the last election wasn't predicted by anybody much. David Cameron, what's interesting is that David Cameron when he was first elected Prime Minister in 2010, had been predicted by everybody to win an outright majority. And he failed to do so, having not winning enough votes in the election, and had to go into a coalition. The fact that he had to go into a coalition and didn't manage to convince the country that this was a brand new moderate party that everybody should get behind has never been forgotten by some of his opponents. And another of the subplots to this rollout of the Lord Ashcroft book is that the editor of the Daily Mail, which is a right-wing newspaper, is seen very much as somebody who, although he should be an ally of David Cameron, being a right-wing paper and a right-wing conservative government, is somebody that thinks David Cameron's a sellout, doesn't really think he believes in the true conservatism. And there's some speculation that he was very keen to get this book and to promote it, and he made a huge offer for the serialization rights, even though there hadn't been rival bids from other newspapers, because a lot of people think he wanted to kind of try and undermine David Cameron. And one thing to remember about Lord Ashcroft is he's not driven by that ideological difference. But yeah, he has some personal differences with David Cameron. But to be honest, I think actually, in a way, Lord Ashcroft might be regretting including the pig story in the book, because what he seems to have been wanting more than anything is to stake a claim for a kind of political statesman. He has a very active Twitter site, and his polls are very widely respected by people on all sides of the political spectrum. And since he kind of split from the conservative hierarchy, he's established himself as a sort of well-respected political figure by both sides. And so I don't think he would have wanted to risk his reputation by writing a book that was written off as just purely a revenge piece. He wanted this to be a serious, unofficial biography of David Cameron. And, you know, we'll see from the following days how much he's reached that goal.
But he's not going to be a spoiler, though. That's the big sin over here with the Republicans. You know, you're not supposed to speak ill of each other. And I take it the chances of him spoiling Cameron's chances aren't that great, because the other side's in disarray, isn't it? The Labour Party.
Well, that's true. But David Cameron's also said he's not going to contest the next election. So the next British election isn't due until 2020, by which time David Cameron's already said he will stand down. So part of what is going on within the Conservative Party already is a kind of jostling for position to see who's going to succeed David Cameron. Now, two of those candidates, funnily enough, were members of the Bullingdon Club, which we mentioned earlier, the rather nasty, posh drinking club at Oxford University. Boris Johnson and George Osborne, who are two very senior figures within the Conservative Party, who are actually two of the favourites to replace David Cameron, and were members of the very same drinking society. There's one famous photograph of them all standing together with their noses sort of slightly raised, looking disdainfully towards the camera, which Cameron and some of his allies have actually tried to quash. They've bought out the rights to reprint the photograph, but you'll still find it lurking around on Twitter if you look hard enough.
So who would Lord Ashcroft then see as a statesman, assuming that he's trying to get somebody in there probably early before Cameron's term is up to bolster the party, the Conservative Party, in the way that he sees it?
It's a very good question, and we don't know the answer to that yet. That will be one of the key things as those candidates do start the race early to decide who can be the next. Because what's slightly different with Britain as well is there's no elected president. So before the next election, whoever succeeds David Cameron as leader of the Conservative Party will become Prime Minister. So, and they will then run in the upcoming election as Prime Minister, which does give you a kind of real engaged advantage over your opponent. So it's even more important than who will succeed, you know, who would succeed President Obama, for example, because you'll actually be running from the White House, as it were. So we don't know yet. And there isn't going to be a big money expensive election leadership campaign between those rival candidates. So it's difficult for Ashcroft to directly influence the result of that. But you can be sure that those people within the Conservative grassroots and who are members of the Conservative Party and who will ultimately get a vote on who the next leader will be, will be watching very closely to see what Ashcroft says, because he is considered to be a wise man within the party.
But when you mention the Bullingdon Club and this these sort of posh characters, and there's a quote in your article which I can't even say on the air, I don't think, where in the book apparently Cameron's one of his campaign chiefs described Cameron as a posh four-letter word starting with C. But when you talk about these characters like Cameron, Boris Johnson and George Osborne belonging to these clubs when they were at Oxford University, the purpose of which, according to the friend of Cameron's, is quoted in the book, James Dellingpole, who's now a journalist, and he's apparently confirmed some of this stuff. In your article at the Daily Beast, Nico Hines, you quote Dellingpole saying, talking about these clubs, "What is basically involved was getting drunk and standing on restaurant tables shouting about effing plebes," said Dellingpole. "It was all about despising poor people. It's about mindless destruction and conspicuous excess and the rather ugly side of upper class life. It's loathsome." Now, that's a pretty powerful description of what you would think a lot of people in Britain would find loathsome, and yet this guy's been elected Prime Minister, and his successors from the Bullingdon Club may well follow him. So what explains what would seem to be a bit of a disconnect in British society?
Well, you're right, it is a disconnect. And one of the things, you know, if you do... if you do surveys on people and you ask them what's the first word you associate with David Cameron, you know, posh would absolutely come right up there. And people don't like that. People do find that off-putting, and that's one of the main reasons why David Cameron didn't win a clear majority in 2010 and why he only just limped over the line in the last election. You have to remember, he's only got a majority of 12 seats in the current parliament, which is a tiny, tiny majority. I mean, if you think, you know, Tony Blair, when he was winning elections in 97 and in the 2000s, he was winning, more than 100-seat majority, so he could do whatever he wanted, really. David Cameron is a much weaker prime minister, partly because of that exact problem. And no doubt when Osborne and Boris Johnson, Boris Johnson in particular is a kind of bumbling upper-class twit kind of character, which some people love because he's good fun and he's very witty and he's certainly very intelligent. But there's no doubt that there is some resentment towards that. And the candidates on the kind of blue-collar side of the party will try to use that against him. And there are two other main candidates. One's called Theresa May, who is a kind of reincarnation of Margaret Thatcher. She's incredibly tough, very strong, very, very disciplined, and incredibly impressive. She'll be one of the people who's hard to beat and will be challenging those guys. There's another guy called Sajid Javid, and he has a kind of rags-to-riches tale. You know, he came from a poor background and has risen up through the ranks, and, you know, if he gets a win behind him, certainly that could capture the mood in a way that David Cameron hasn't been able to. The reason that Cameron's been winning these elections is because the Labour Party has been in just complete disarray, and that situation has only gotten worse with the election of this sort of extreme left-wing character, Jeremy Corbyn, who it looks likely, if he manages to hang around long enough, will make it much easier for the Conservatives to win another election in 2020.
Well, Nico Hines, I thank you very much for joining us here today from London.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Nico Hines, who is the London editor of the Daily Beast. He previously was a reporter for the Times of London and more recently was their Washington correspondent. His latest article at the Daily Beast is David Cameron Accused of Sex Act with a Dead Pig. And we're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about the latest polls and the Iowa rally of George Bush. The latest polls, of course, since the second Republican debate.
send in the clouds. Just when I stopped opening doors, finally finding the one that I wanted was yours, making my entrance again with my youth.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Redlawsk, who is a polling expert and professor of political science at Rutgers University. He is the co-author of Why Iowa, How Caucuses and Sequential Elections Improve the Presidential Nominating Process. And he's currently a fellow at the Harking Institute at Drake University in Des Moines, Iowa. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Redlawsk.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And David, you at a Jeb Bush rally in Iowa, and I guess the latest polls are pretty bad news for Jeb Bush. They're even worse news for Governor Scott Walker, who polled below 1% in both polls, and I think as a result of these polls, decided today to drop out of the race. What's your sense of what's happening there on the ground in Iowa in Jeb Bush land?
Yeah, you know, it's difficult to get a handle on what's going on around here because there are so many candidates. You know, Scott Walker dropping clears it a little bit more, but not a whole lot. Bush is one of those who was thought to have a pretty good shot, ought to be leading, but at the moment he's very much at the back of the pack. Having said that, the event tonight was well attended. The crowd seemed very positive towards him, and he actually seemed quite animated. I thought maybe because Scott Walker dropped out.
So was there much of a buzz, though, about because everybody was waiting after this second debate to see how well Carly Fiorina would do and whether or not this, I guess, the Trump magic or whatever you want to call it, you know, for the longest time, the punditry has been predicting that these outrageous statements and the general outrageous nature of this candidate's race in the first place, which is to many who followed politics over the years is quite, you know, inexplicable, if not appalling. Nevertheless, Trump seems to defy the professional pollsters and politicos, and he's staying in there. And according to both the NBC poll and the CNN poll, he's ahead.
Well, I take the CNN poll more seriously, by the way. The NBC poll is not a random sample poll. It's an online survey for a whole host of reasons. I tend to discount those right now. But in terms of the CNN poll, yes, Trump is in the lead, but he's actually down 8 points from their last poll. That's the first time we've seen a real visible national drop for Trump. It's most likely because nationally, Republicans think he did a pretty bad job at the debate. A third of them in that CNN poll said the guy lost the debate. More than half said Carly Fiorina won it, and as a consequence, her numbers have jumped significantly.
Her numbers now, according to the CNN poll, are 15%, Trump at 24%, Fiorina at 15%, Ben Carson at 14%, and Senator Marco Rubio at 11%. And then the rest are just way down there.
Right. Yeah, well, I had the opportunity to watch CNN's focus group in person the other night, and it was clear that they were very taken by Fiorina. I think it's important to recognize she's at 15, which doesn't sound like much, but she was at 3 before. So that's a massive jump in a very short period of time. The real question for Fiorina here in Iowa is, can she capitalize on it? She currently doesn't seem to have any significant staff on the ground. She doesn't seem to have a real organization yet. And so if money follows the polling numbers, and it might allow her to start building the necessary groundwork to get voters out.
So when you say that the NBC poll, you don't take it particularly seriously, it was conducted by SurveyMonkey, which is a different kind of polling, right? They collect large amounts of large samples of Americans, then weigh the results to match known demographic statistics such as age, race, and gender. And they have been, what has been pointed out is that they were the only people who got the UK election results correct, the more recent one. So what is it about them that you don't think is good when they seem to be getting fairly good press here?
Well, you know, we don't really know how accurate anybody is right now. But what I do know about those kinds of online surveys is they have to do a huge amount of statistical work in the background, a lot of we call it weighting of the data to make things match up. And weighting's not bad except for two things. One, it introduces a great deal of additional error that, because there's no traditional margin of error on that poll, is impossible to really account for. And the second is that weighting only works if the people who are not part of the poll are just like the people who are part of the poll. So if people who are not part of this online sample have the same opinions as those who are, then that's great. No big problem. On the other hand, if they're very different, weighting won't solve that. This poll is it's a national poll. It's a large N, but numbers alone don't solve the problem. And it's pretty different from the CNN poll, which is a much more traditional telephone survey. I'll also note that when we look at change, which everybody tends to focus on, the CNN poll is looking at change over a different period of time than the NBC poll.
And again, I'm speaking with David Redlosk, who's a polling expert and a professor of political science at Rutgers University. He's the co-author of Why Iowa, How Caucuses and Sequential Elections Improve the Presidential Nominating Process. And he's currently a fellow at the Harkin Institute at Drake University in Des Moines, Iowa. And he's attending a Jeb Bush rally in, whereabouts in Iowa are you tonight?
We are in Mason City, otherwise known in the Music Man as River City, Iowa.
I see. Is there trouble?
I don't know. There may be. It didn't seem like it tonight, though. I've got to say that Jeb Bush was much more animated than the last time I saw him in person at the state fair. And, he took a lot of questions. This was a town hall. And, I don't think he got a lot of commitments out of it. But that's typical in Iowa. Voters want to see these guys several times before they're ready to commit.
So was he asked about the questions of the day, which is largely about Trump and Ben Carson making Islamophobic remarks?
Interestingly enough, the Islamophobic remarks did not come up. I was a little bit surprised by that. You had a range of other questions, the issue of Planned Parenthood and its defunding, questions about abortion. But you also had a lot of questions simply about economics and the environment and a whole range of the things you'd expect people to be concerned about. Not a single really process question. People want to know the answer to issues. I will add that the Scott Walker news had not necessarily gotten through the crowd. I was listening ahead of time, and there was only a little bit of talk about it. When Governor Bush got up, one of the first things he said was, two surprising things this week. In the last week, two good men dropped out, Governor Perry and Governor Walker, and there was a real sort of like, reaction in the crowd.
But in terms of the Planned Parenthood debate, one of the things that was particularly disappointing about the second, the CNN debate last Wednesday night, the second Republican presidential primary debate, was when Carly Fiorina made that impassioned statement about Planned Parenthood and challenged Hillary Clinton to watch the video of a live fetus with its heart beating and its legs kicking as it's about to be sliced apart for body parts. Nobody, the moderator didn't check it for saying, well, that's not true. They're simply not in the video. And so did Jeb Bush in any way challenge the veracity? I mean, now that Carly Fiorina is climbing up, you'd think that they'd want to at least pull her over in terms of the veracity of what her statements are.
So the short answer, no, he did not. And in fact, he didn't really take on any of his opponents, except for brief mention of Donald Trump in a, and I can't, of course, pull that out of my head exactly what he said, but it wasn't a particularly positive comment. Uh-huh. And so when but he stayed very much focused on, the questions people were asking, and nobody asked those kinds of process questions. It is interesting, right? I mean, we see all these fact checkers out there after something like a debate or other speeches, other events. And, the fact checkers do their job and they, write stories about the facts that weren't facts. And it doesn't seem to matter a whole lot. And part of the reason it doesn't matter a whole lot, there are really two reasons. One is that people actually don't particularly trust the media any more than they trust political candidates. In fact, maybe even less. I have a new book out called The Positive Case for Negative Campaigning, and we talk a little bit about the media's role in fact-checking. It just doesn't work because people don't believe them. But the second reason it doesn't is that, things like what Fiorina said about, a live fetus, its heart beating on the, lying on the table, are meant to grab people at a gut level. And no amount of facts is going to make a particular difference in that case.
Well, it certainly in the bygone days, journalists in these presidential debates, and particularly when they were run by the League of Women Voters, they definitely pulled over candidates when they made howlers and made statements that simply weren't true. And I think your point is well taken, that probably much of the audiences in these primaries distrust the press more than anything. But, when the fact checkers are a day late and a dollar short, though, aren't they? I mean, it's the impression that happens in the moment that is the lasting one. And this last debate certainly got record viewers for CNN. Did it do better in terms of overall numbers than the first debate on Fox?
I think it did, if I recall correctly. But I do know that it was a huge hit for CNN. I think they'd be happy to have, Donald Trump in the center of debates forever. And they wouldn't be arguing about should we only have six. They'd like to do them all the time. They made a lot of money on that debate. Let me comment about the moderators, though. And you're right. There probably was a time when moderators may have seen their job as a little more intruding into the process, right, in terms of corrections or pushing candidates or what have you. We still get a little of the pushing. We still get a little of the, you did not answer that question, and we saw that on Wednesday night. But because most of these questioners, moderators, tend to be journalists, the journalistic tendency is not to be the ones to insert themselves, but to let every side talk and the truth will come out.
Right, but the way that CNN set up that last debate was that they basically tried to pit everybody against each other, because they had this rule that if anybody insulted you on stage, you automatically had a right to a rebuttal. And everybody knew that Donald Trump would insult people. And, of course, in his first opening statement, he arbitrarily insulted Rand Paul out of nowhere. And thus you got a kind of chain reaction, you know?
Yeah, but I think what happened there was he actually misunderstood who had made the comment the moderator was referring to. Uh-huh. Because it wasn't, it had come out of, it had come out of the first debate, and it wasn't Rand Paul. Uh-huh. I think he simply misheard and he went off on Rand Paul. Right. That's how I read it. It doesn't matter because, it did what it did. But I'm sure the CNN execs were sitting back going, this is great TV. I don't know if it's great for the American public, but I'm not sure it's that bad. I mean, debates are kind of deadly boring a lot of the time. If you can get people to watch and pay attention, my take as someone who studies the role of information in elections is that, people pay so little attention. If this is what it takes to grab them, it may not be the greatest thing in the world, but people came away from that debate knowing more than they did when they went in.
Well, knowing about what? They didn't get any information in terms of policy. They got information in terms of how candidates maybe are on certain issues, or who was the most aggressive on the anti-abortion issue or against Planned Parenthood, who wants to bomb ISIS and whatever. But I don't recall. I mean, in the whole point of this setup of where you could have an automatic rebuttal to an insult meant that if you were one of those candidates, the smart thing to do was to insult somebody because it gave you more airtime. And the person who didn't insult Huckabee barely got a word out.
Barely got a word in. Some truth to that, Ian, but there was also policy in there, that the things you just mentioned are policy positions. They're, you know, they may not couch them in exact detailed terms because it's just they're not going to for a whole lot of reasons. But, you know, you would come away from that, let's say you knew not a whole lot to start with, you can come away with some sense of some differences across these candidates. Oddly enough, and maybe it's because there were only four candidates, the kids' table debate, the undercard, was actually a pretty darn good debate in which, you know, two candidates took a very conservative line, two candidates, I wouldn't call them moderate, but, you know, they differentiated themselves from the other two. And I thought that was quite interesting. Of course, I don't think anyone actually watched that one.
Well, just in the last minute or so then, back to these polls, and you're dubious, yeah, about the CNN, I mean, the CBS poll that has Trump at 30%, Ben Carson in second place at 14%, and Carly Fiorina in third place with 11%, whereas the other poll, the CNN poll, has Trump at 24%, Fiorina at 15%, Ben Carson at 14%, and Senator Marco Rubio at 11%. So in terms of Fiorina, do you think that her rise will mean more scrutiny? I mean, is that how it's working? Or in Trump's case, he defies scrutiny.
Yeah, well, it's because Trump is honestly entertainment. And I think in many respects, it's difficult to scrutinize a guy who essentially answers every question with, I'm the greatest, we'll do the greatest things ever. There's not a lot there to scrutinize in some sense. But you're right. I mean, Fiorina will get more scrutiny. People will pay more attention. Her tenure at HP in particular is likely to become fodder down the road if she shows that she can keep this going. I mean, it's also possible it's a one-time blip based on an immediate reaction to a debate, and she may have trouble solidifying it.
Well, David Redlawski, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're welcome. Enjoyed it much.
And again, I've been speaking with David Redlawski, who's a polling expert and a professor of political science at Rutgers University. He's the co-author of Why Iowa, How Caucuses and Sequential Elections Improve the Presidential Nominating Process. And he has a new book, The Positive Case for Negative Campaigning. And he's currently a fellow at the Harkin Institute at Drake University in Des Moines, Iowa. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time was